Our first case for argument is United States v. Velar and others. Mr. Robinson.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Matthew Robinson on behalf of the appellant, Robert Velar. Mr. Velar today stands convicted of one count of conspiracy to distribute 5 kilograms or more of cocaine, possession with intent to distribute cocaine, and use of a telephone in furtherance these crimes. In this brief time we have for oral argument, I'd like to address the second issue raised in our brief, which deals with the sufficiency of the evidence concerning the conspiracy conviction. Mr. Velar readily admitted to the authorities, although that admission is part of a suppression issue in this brief, but he readily admitted to the authorities his involvement in at least two transactions involving a kilogram of cocaine each from the leader of this conspiracy, Mr. Iniguez, I'm sorry for the pronunciation. At the close of the government's case and at the close of trial and after the verdict, Mr. Velar raised an argument that the verdict was in against the manifest weight of the evidence concerning the conspiracy conviction, not the distribution or the possession conviction, but the conspiracy. And we would submit that the evidence adduced at trial does support a possession with intent to distribute conviction, but does not support a conspiracy. And there's a couple reasons for that. First of all, the conspiracy in this case was a vast conspiracy involving hundreds of kilograms of cocaine, Mexican drug dealers, drug supplies coming out of Mexico. Mr. Velar was involved in 2 1-kilogram transactions for, I think, $18,500 each. In this instance, we submit that this is nothing more than a buyer-seller relationship, especially when you compare it to the overall conspiracy as a whole. Convictions for conspiracy cannot be sustained solely on the basis of circumstantial evidence, and I admit there's plenty of circumstantial evidence here, but they cannot be sustained solely on that circumstantial evidence if the evidence contains no basis for the jury to distinguish the conspiracy from the underlying buyer-seller relationship. And here, there really is no difference in Mr. Velar's situation between the conspiracy evidence and the underlying buyer-seller relationship. The quote that I just read was out of the USA versus Johnson case, 592 Fed 3rd 749. It's a 2010 case out of the Seventh Circuit, of course. In this instance, one of the things, first of all, the evidence of a conspiratorial relationship includes sales on credit, agreement to look for other customers, paying sales commissions, one party advises the other party how to conduct their transactions, things like that, or agreements to warn or help with future transactions. Here, the only thing that comes close to that is sales on credit. Transactions that occurred, admittedly, were a sale on credit where Mr. Velar would obtain a kilo of cocaine and pay for it 1 or 2 days later. And essentially that is the only basis that I see that the government could even claim there's a conspiratorial relationship here. But if there is a conspiratorial relationship, it's not the conspiracy charged in this indictment. There are, as I discussed, hundreds and hundreds of kilograms of cocaine being distributed through this conspiracy all across the country from different areas of the country. Mr. Velar was involved in these two unique transactions. And unlike other cases, there is no agreement from Velar's part to look for customers or a sales commission that he's receiving from Iniguez or Hernandez, I guess, which is Iniguez's right-hand man in this distribution network.
But there was a long-standing relationship, and in addition to the sales on credit, extensions of time to pay and other indicia of involvement in the conspiracy that take this outside of the Johnson case.
Again, I would agree that it is distinguishable somewhat from the Johnson case because of that. But I would point out in Johnson there were discussions about buying and selling on credit, The court just found that the evidence wasn't sufficient enough in that case to show that there was a sale on credit or buying and selling on credit in that situation. And here I think it's similar. There is, I see that my time's up, if I could finish this point real quickly. The only point I have here with regard to this is that the sale on credit was not something that occurred over and over again over time, and it is only a two-time occasion, and it was based on his knowledge of Mr. Iniguez. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Robinson. Ms. Belasis.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Villia Belasis on behalf of Defendant Amador Hernandez. Mr. Hernandez was not a manager or supervisor in Mr. Iniguez's drug organization. Nevertheless, the judge gave him 3 points, a three-point adjustment to his overall offense level for that. He was essentially a gopher, a runner. He delivered drugs and money at the behest of Mr. Iniguez. That Mr. Iniguez characterized him as his right-hand man does not change his role into a supervisory one. He didn't recruit accomplices. He didn't get a larger share of proceeds. In fact, the evidence is that he was paid several hundred dollars for each of the tasks that he was asked to do. And more than that, he didn't coordinate, organize, or supervise anyone or anything. The government maintains that Iniguez trusted Hernandez, and he did. He trusted Mr. Hernandez not to steal his drugs or his money. He was a trusted runner. The question is, what was the degree of participation of Mr. Hernandez in planning and organizing any of these activities, and the degree of control and authority exercised over others? And there really wasn't any. The government claims that Amador Hernandez was supervising Mr. Salinas and Mr. King. The trial transcript shows that Mr. Iniguez gave a telephone number, that of his source, to Hernandez and Hernandez alone. And this source was to tell Mr. Hernandez how to open a hidden compartment. What Mr. Iniguez tells Mr. Hernandez is he is going to explain to you and Ray, meaning to you and Mr. Salinas, how to open up the combination. There is nothing in that transcript about Mr. Hernandez supervising Mr. Salinas. And later on, in a telephone conversation between Mr. Iniguez and Mr. Salinas tells Mr. Iniguez, we are working on it. Again, this was a joint effort between Mr. Hernandez and Mr. Salinas, but not one supervising the other. With respect to Mr. King, Mr. Hernandez's role was to deliver drugs to Mr. King at Mr. Iniguez's instructions, and to pick up money and deliver that money to others, again, at Mr. Iniguez's direct instruction. His instructions from Mr. Iniguez was also to, at one point in time, to keep the drugs from Mr. King. And because, evidently, he couldn't keep Mr. King from the location where the drugs were, he moved the drugs. But the fact that someone takes it upon himself to go around a roadblock when delivering drugs or performing a task like that does not mean that he is now a supervisor or an organizer. He's still a runner, and the judge clearly erred in adding 3 points to Mr. Hernandez's offense level. Regarding the
Iniguez's assistant?
He assisted him to the extent that when Mr. Iniguez said, go deliver these drugs, he delivered them. When Mr. Iniguez said, go pick up the money, he picked it up.
He's not just a messenger. He does exercise some discretion, doesn't he?
Not really.
Well, he's not just going down the street or across town. He's going all over the country at Mr. Iniguez's
behest. That's right.
Representing him.
That's correct. However, he is performing the role of a courier. He's not representing him and making any decisions.
Courier is something you just give a package to and he delivers it at the other end. A courier doesn't talk to anybody, right? Just picks up the package, drops it off. He doesn't.
Well,
more than that here, isn't there?
Not much. I mean, yes, they did talk.
There is more.
But
you say not much. There is more.
There is more than that in terms of his participation.
Assistant. He's an assistant.
He assists in the sense that he and Mr. Salinas are looking for and open up the compartment. So he does that, but there's nothing supervisory or there's no supervisory role that he takes and no planning that he does.
Well, he superintends the sales. He takes the money.
He takes the money and he brings the drugs, but he doesn't decide prices. He doesn't decide amounts.
Are you saying Iniguez is the only supervisor in this gang?
Iniguez was the one who ran things, and then
answer my question. Is he the only supervisor?
No,
he's
not.
Who are the other supervisors?
I believe Mr. Pedroza was supervising one aspect of the conspiracy.
Is that it? He's the only other.
Mr. King had several other people working for him.
How large was the conspiracy? How many members?
I'm not sure. There were a lot.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Belasis. Mr. Carlson?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Kent Carlson, and I represent Eladio Pedroza, Sr. We're here today because Judge Dara effectively sentenced Mr. Pedroza to life in prison.
Yeah, he knew he was doing that. He explained why he was doing that. What more is necessary? Well, you want to have a per se rule that nobody can ever be, no old people can be given long sentences?
Judge Dara did.
Is that the rule you're contending for?
I am not. I am saying that there were factors in this case.
But Judge Dara considered them.
I don't believe Judge Dara did.
What did he leave out?
I don't believe Judge Dara considered the issues of the likelihood of Mr. Pedroza committing any further crimes or, again, illegally reentering the United States.
Well, obviously he's going to commit. This is his career, right? He didn't get out of it when he was young. Still doing in his 50s. Why won't he be doing it in his 60s?
Judge, because a sentence, even if it was less than what was imposed here, would have put him in his late 70s when he was released from prison. Judge Dara never addressed whether the age factor would have any impact on.
So you're saying nobody should be kept in prison when he's what, 75?
I'm not saying that there should be a blanket rule. I'm saying in a case
where. Well, what would be an exception?
Well, I think an exception would be if a judge were to consider all the facts and circumstances and make a finding that the particular person before him is likely at age 77 or 80 to commit further crimes or further reenter the United States. That would be a different story. But Judge Dara didn't do that here. He didn't consider. He considered things like Mr. Pedroza's illegal reentries at age 18 and at 50-something, but then went on to say that I think if he were deported to Mexico after he served his sentence here, he'd come back. Well, I don't think that without looking at the fact that he would be 77 to 80 years old at the time that that happens, is appropriate. I think he needs to consider those issues. He needs to consider what the Department of Justice statistics show about recidivism rates as people get older. And we're talking here about why a sentence of an effective death.
You're not saying, are you, that recidivism is the only thing a judge should consider and decide on the length of a sentence?
No, I am not.
He has quite a criminal career. So doesn't that argue for a heavy punishment?
And
you don't want to have a situation, do you, where everybody, all criminals get to retire 75?
And I am not suggesting that his criminal history wasn't significant. It was. But his criminal history score already took that into consideration. Just as the facts of this case are aggravating facts of this case. They were taken into consideration at arriving at the advisory guideline range. Judge Dara is then taking those same facts and looking at those again and trying to decide whether a guideline sentence is appropriate or not without looking at the flip side of that, being that those things are mitigated to a large extent by the fact that he's going to be between 77 and 80 years
old.
What
do the Justice Department statistics show that you suggest should have been considered?
That recidivism rates decrease with age, especially.
Yeah, he's already defied that rule.
Well, he has. At 57. Well, he's 57 at the time of sentencing.
It was,
but at 70 or 80, I'm suggesting it's different at that age.
Is that what the statistics show? Or are you just speculating?
I don't know what they show as far as when it gets up to what age.
Is there a difference between 57 and 70?
That I don't know, Your Honor. Other than that, I would rely on what's contained in our brief.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Ms. Levin?
May it please the Court, my name is Jenny Levin, and I represent the United States. The evidence, when viewed in the light most favorable to the government, was sufficient to find Defendant Villar guilty of the charged drug conspiracy.
I'm wondering about the conspiracy versus buyer-seller issue in the Villar's case. You say in your brief, you imply in your brief, page 58, that sales on credit by themselves establish conspiracy. You never have a mere buyer-seller relationship if there's credit.
Yes, Your Honor, and if I could expand on that.
What are you arguing for?
In Johnson, the Court stressed that sales on consignment is quintessential evidence of conspiracy, as opposed to strictly sales on credit. When sales on credit are for a consumer amount, an individual amount, and let's say it only happens once. Here, we have sales on credit for distribution-size quantities of cocaine. We have repeated transactions. And we also have other factors that we can look at that support that there was a conspiratorial relationship as opposed to a mere buyer-seller relationship. For example, Mr. Villar advised Enriquez as to the status of his operation. He would inform him whether or not buyers had come through because Enriquez had a financial interest in Villar's resale of the drugs. He wouldn't get paid, the organization wouldn't get paid if Mr. Villar didn't move the drugs. In addition, the evidence at trial demonstrated that there was a significant amount of trust between Mr. Enriquez and Mr. Villar. For example, when Mr. Enriquez would go to pick up the money from Mr. Villar, Enriquez testified that he didn't even count it because he trusted Mr. Villar 100%. For all of these reasons, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, there was sufficient evidence to find Defendant Villar guilty of the charged drug conspiracy. The district court did not clearly err in enhancing Defendant Hernandez's offense level 3 points pursuant to Guideline Section 3B1.1b because Hernandez played a supervisory role in the charged drug conspiracy. The evidence at trial demonstrated that Mr. Hernandez was Mr. Enriquez's right-hand man. For example, Mr. Enriquez took Mr. Hernandez with him in 2004 when he traveled to Cleveland so Mr. Hernandez could meet Gonzalo Sanchez, who was a large customer in Cleveland. Enriquez testified that he did this because he wanted Mr. Hernandez to know Mr. Sanchez so in the future the two of them could conduct the business on their own. In addition, the evidence demonstrated that Mr. Hernandez oversaw the shipment of two large loads of cocaine that were arriving in Kentucky. While he was in Kentucky, he supervised the activities of his co-conspirators, Raymond Salinas and Philip King. In addition, the evidence demonstrated that Enriquez wanted Mr. Hernandez in Kentucky because he trusted him in ways that he did not trust Mr. King and Mr. Salinas. For example, Mr. Hernandez was given the phone number to Mr. Enriquez's Mexican source of supply. Mr. Enriquez testified that he did not want anybody but Mr. Hernandez to have this phone number, not Mr. Salinas and not Mr. King. Enriquez also communicated to others in the conspiracy that Hernandez was his right-hand man. For example, he told Juan Sanchez, his Mexican source of supply, that Mr. Hernandez was the one in charge in Kentucky. In addition, later on in the conspiracy, Mr. Enriquez told Jose Ocampo, who was also one of his co-conspirators, that Mr. Hernandez was the one in charge of a shipment of cocaine that had arrived from L.A. Mr. Hernandez regularly conferred with Mr. Enriquez as to the status of the operation, and his supervisory role is also apparent through the tasks he took on in the organization. For these reasons, the district court did not err in applying a three-point enhancement, finding that Mr. Hernandez was a supervisor or manager. The district court properly considered the factors set forth in Section 3553A and imposed a reasonable sentence when it sentenced Mr. Pedroza to 360 months in prison. As the record demonstrates, the district court gave meaningful consideration to Mr. Pedroza's arguments in mitigation, including his age argument. However, in light of other countervailing factors, the district court decided to impose a within-guideline sentence.
What about Mr. Carlson's point that it's improbable that Pedroza would be committing crimes in his late 70s or 80s?
I would disagree that it's improbable that Mr. Pedroza would necessarily be committing crimes. All the district court could do was look at his past behavior to try to predict his future behavior. And his past behavior demonstrates that he served two lengthy prison sentences, one for 4 years, one for 10 years, for distribution of cocaine imposed by a judge in this district, and still continued to commit offenses. In addition, he had illegally reentered the country on three prior occasions. This demonstrates that if he was deported after his imprisonment was over, he would probably reenter again. The district court
do slow down eventually.
Yes, Your Honor, you do slow down eventually. I agree with that. However, all the court
with
could
good
do.
Time, when would he get out?
I'm sorry?
With good time, when would he get out?
I believe.
On a 30-year sentence? 57?
About 80.
Is that less or so? Is that
about 80 years old, I believe.
It's 85%.
15%?
So
he'll be in his 80s.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, there were other factors that the district court looked at when imposing this sentence, including the nature and circumstances of the offense and Pedroza's role in the conspiracy, noting that Mr. Pedroza controlled some of the individuals in this conspiracy while he was incarcerated in a federal penitentiary. He also looked at his criminal history and his personal characteristics, the likelihood that he would recidivate, and the need for deterrence. Because the district court properly calculated the guideline sentence, and because the district court talked about the statutory factors and imposed a reasonable sentence, Pedroza's sentence should be affirmed. If the court has no further questions, I'll end by asking that the court affirm defendant Villar's conviction, affirm the sentences of all three defendants, and affirm the district court's denial of Mr. Hernandez's and Mr. Villar's motion to suppress. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Levin. Is there anything further from any of the defendant's lawyers? Well, thank you very much. And Ms. Belisis and Mr. Carlson, you were appointed, were you not? So we thank you very much for accepting the appointment. And we thank Mr. Robinson as well and Ms. Levin.